Welcome to the show, everyone. Today, we have a bit of a unique situation. We're going to be diving into two Maryland cases. And get this, they both have the same name, Hebron v. State.
It's like we've got legal doppelgangers on our hands.
Exactly, but don't worry, we're going to keep everything straight for you.
And to add to the fun, these cases tackle very different legal issues.
So we've got one case that grapples with the right to counsel at bail hearings, and the other dives headfirst into the world of circumstantial evidence and jury instructions.
Two concepts that, let's face it, every lawyer out there has to deal with at some point.
So let's kick things off with the first Hebron v. State, the one decided back in 1971. This case centered around Charles Hebron, who was arrested for burglary and theft.
Okay, setting the scene. Got it.
Now here's where things get interesting. At his bail hearings, Hebron didn't have a lawyer. And get this, there wasn't any evidence presented against him either.
So the whole focus was basically on setting the bail amount.
You got it. And this brings up a huge question.
Was Hebron denied his Sixth Amendment right to counsel?
Ding, ding, ding. We have a winner. But to really unpack that, we need to think back to another landmark case. Coleman v. Alabama.
Ah, yes. Coleman. Mm-hmm. The case that gave us the idea of critical stages in a criminal proceeding. Those stages where the right to counsel is so crucial, it's make or break time for ensuring a fair process.
So the million-dollar question in Hebron's case was, did his bail hearing, where remember no evidence was presented, fall under that critical stage umbrella, meaning he should have had a lawyer there?
Right, because if it was, then his rights were potentially violated.
So what did the Maryland court decide? Drum roll, please.
Well, they ended up drawing a line between Hebron's case and Coleman.
Interesting. How so?
They basically said, look, because no evidence was presented against Hebron, his bail hearing wasn't a stage where having a lawyer would have made a big difference in the outcome.
So they're saying a lawyer's presence wouldn't have significantly impacted the outcome because of that lack of evidence.
Right.
But wouldn't you say that, I mean, come on, any point where someone's freedom is on the line could be seen as critical?
You know, you bring up a really valid point, and some people would definitely argue that having a lawyer at any stage is just plain beneficial, but the court's thinking here, their logic, was that this bail hearing, it was purely procedural, all about making sure the defendant would show up for trial.
Not about going toe-to-toe with the evidence against them.
Precisely.
So let's break this down for all the lawyers and future lawyers out there listening.
Mm-hmm.
What does this case mean for them, especially when they're dealing with bail hearings in Maryland?
It's a bit of a heads up, a signal that if you've got a bail hearing where, like in Hebron's case, no evidence is on the table, trying to push for that right to counsel, well, it might be an uphill battle.
I see. So energy might be better spent focusing on making sure the process itself is fair. Arguing for a reasonable bail amount, looking into alternatives to jail time, things like that.
Exactly. You're spot on. It all comes down to knowing the legal landscape you're playing in and making sure your strategies fit the situation.
So we've tackled Hebron case number one, highlighting how the right to counsel can get a little tricky depending on what stage of the process you're in. Now, let's switch gears. We're moving on to our second Hebron v. State case. Different Hebron, different legal battle, and this time we're wading into the world of circumstantial evidence.
Bring on the mystery.
All right, so this case deals with Wayne Hebron, and he was convicted of breaking and entering. But here's the catch. The whole case hinged on circumstantial evidence.
Meaning no one actually saw him doing the deed, right?
Right. We're talking about neighbors spotting him near the scene, a door that was definitely forced open, but no smoking gun, no eyewitness saying, hey, I saw that guy breaking in.
Ah, so we're in the land of inferences where it's all about piecing together the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
What were the big legal questions in this one?
Well, the heart of the matter was a jury instruction the defense wanted the judge to give. They wanted the jury to be told that if the circumstantial evidence, all those puzzle pieces, could be interpreted in multiple ways, reasonable ways, mind you, then they had to acquit. Meaning, if they could come up with another plausible explanation for Hebron being there, that's it. Case closed.
Makes sense. When in doubt, right? Benefit of doubt goes to the defendant.
That's what the defense thought, too. But the court, not so much. They actually disagreed.
They did. Okay, now I'm really intrigued. Why?
They said that whole reasonable hypothesis of innocence thing, that standard, it really applies to the judge, specifically when the judge is deciding if there's even enough evidence to go to trial in the first place.
So they're basically saying the judge acts like a filter, making sure the evidence is strong enough before it even gets to the jury.
Exactly. And once it passes that filter, it's the jury's job to decide if they believe the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, so the court's saying, hey, jury, Your job isn't to get bogged down in whether the evidence is direct or circumstantial. You look at the whole picture and you tell us if it convinces you of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Now, this case also brings up another interesting point, and it all revolves around how we define certain elements of a crime. I mean, they convicted Wayne Hebron of breaking and entering, right?
Right.
But no one actually saw him go into the house. So how did they prove he entered the place?
That, my friend, is where things get really interesting. It all comes down to a tiny but super important legal detail, how Maryland law defines entering.
So spill the beans. What's the secret?
In Maryland, entering doesn't mean you have to be fully inside a place. Nope. Even the slightest intrusion, like a hand reaching through a window or a tool used to pry open a door, boom, that meets the legal definition of entering.
Wow, so that's huge, especially in cases where circumstantial evidence is the star of the show.
It definitely highlights how important it is to know those nitty-gritty legal definitions. Sometimes, those seemingly tiny details can make or break a case.
Okay, so in Wayne Hebron's case, the messed up door and the fact that they found wood chips inside, those were enough to convince the jury that he had, in the eyes of the law, entered the house.
Bingo. Even without someone saying, I saw him step inside.
So lawyers out there, listen up. You've really got to dig into those statutory definitions, especially when you're building a case around circumstantial evidence.
It's about knowing exactly what needs to be proven and how the evidence you have, even if it's circumstantial, lines up with those elements. You've got to connect those dots.
So here we are, two Hebron cases, both dealing with procedural stuff and how courts interpret the roles of the judge and the jury.
Yes, and while they might seem different at first glance, both cases give us some valuable insights into how the legal system works in Maryland. They're like these little reminders that sometimes the smallest details can have a big impact.
And knowing those nuances of legal definitions and how things work procedurally, well, that's crucial for any lawyer practicing in Maryland. You know, it's really interesting how these two Hebron cases, even though they're dealing with different issues, they both kind of underline the importance of really clearly defining those roles in the legal process. You know, who does what?
Yeah, it's like the courts are saying, look, the judge has their job, the jury has theirs, and let's not blur those lines.
Right. In the 1971 case, it was all about the judge deciding if a lawyer is even needed at a particular stage, like those bail hearings. And then in Wayne Hebron's case, the judge is kind of like a gatekeeper for the evidence, right? Making sure it's strong enough before it goes to the jury.
Exactly. It's like this careful dance between the judge setting the stage and the jury ultimately deciding the case.
But let's go back to that 1971 case for a sec.
Yeah.
I mean, some people would argue that having a lawyer by your side at every single stage is just crucial, even those bail hearings that seem more about procedure than anything else.
Yeah, and that's a really important point. The idea that everyone deserves a lawyer no matter what, especially when they're going up against the power of the state.
But I guess there's another side to that, right? What are the arguments against having a lawyer at absolutely every stage?
Well, one thing courts often have to think about is, you know, resources. Providing lawyers for every single hearing, I mean, that could really strain the system. It's about finding that balance between making sure things are fair and, let's be real, the practical side of how the courts actually work.
So it's this constant tension between, like, individual rights and keeping the wheels of justice turning.
Exactly. And that's something lawyers really need to understand, especially when they're giving advice to clients.
Okay, so thinking practically, if you're a lawyer in Maryland after that 1971 Hebron case, what's the best way to approach a bail hearing where no evidence is actually being presented?
Well, you've got to shift your focus a bit. Instead of trying to fight the charges head on at that point, it's more about making sure the process is fair. So you might challenge the bail amount itself, maybe point out things that make your client less of a flight risk, you know, like ties to the community, stable job, things like that.
Or even see if there are alternatives to jail, like house arrest.
Exactly. It's about working within the system, knowing the rules of the game, and trying to get the best outcome for your client within those rules.
Okay, now let's jump back to Wayne Hebron's case and that whole discussion about circumstantial evidence. The court decided not to give that specific instruction about multiple interpretations, you know, the one the defense wanted. But that brings up a question. How should lawyers handle circumstantial evidence when they're presenting it to a jury?
It really becomes about telling a story. It's like you're giving the jury all these pieces of a puzzle, and you've got to show them how those pieces fit together, how they lead to a specific conclusion.
So it's not just about saying, here's a fingerprint, here's a witness who saw the guy near the scene. It's about explaining why those things matter.
Right. Exactly. And this is where Wayne Hebron's case actually gives us some pretty valuable insight, especially for defense attorneys. Remember how the court emphasized that it's the judge's job to decide if there's even enough evidence to go to trial?
Right, like that filter we talked about.
Well, that highlights how important those pretrial motions can be, especially that motion for judgment of acquittal.
That's where you're basically saying, hold up, judge, this evidence just isn't strong enough to convict my client.
Right. Exactly. If you can convince the judge of that, the case might be dismissed before it even reaches the jury.
So it's like a two-part strategy for defense attorneys. First, you try to knock out the evidence early on.
Mm-hmm.
And if that doesn't work, then you focus on presenting your side of the story to the jury, raising those reasonable doubts that might lead to an acquittal.
That's a great way to put it. Both of these Hebron cases, in their own way, really show us how important it is to understand what each person in the courtroom does, what their role is.
And they remind us that even tiny little details, like that definition of entering in Wayne Hebron's case, can have a huge impact.
Totally. It's like lawyers need to be detectives, right? They've got to really examine those facts, those legal definitions, those procedural rules. It's all about building the strongest case you can.
You know, these Hebron cases have given us a lot to think about.
They really have.
We've talked about strategies for both sides. We've seen how little legal points can sometimes make a big difference.
And you know what? In our last segment, we're going to zoom out a bit. We're going to connect these cases to some bigger trends in the legal system and leave you with some questions to ponder, some things to really chew on.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. As we wrap up our deep dive into these Hebron v. State cases, it's kind of wild how these two cases, decided years apart, end up touching on some really big questions about how our legal system actually works.
Yeah, and what we see in these Hebron cases, it's not like some weird one-off thing. It actually reflects this bigger trend, this constant evolution of those safeguards, those procedures that are supposed to protect people as they go through the legal system.
Right. It's like the law itself is this living, breathing thing, you know, always adapting, always trying to find that balance between being efficient and also making sure individual rights are protected.
I like that. That's a great way to think about it. It's like fine-tuning a really complex machine. Each case, each ruling, it's like a little tweak, trying to get the system to be more just, more accurate.
So if we kind of zoom out and look at the bigger picture, what do these Hebron cases tell us about where we're at, you know, as a society? Are we moving in the right direction when it comes to balancing those different interests, those competing values?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it's one that people are always debating, always grappling with. I mean, you look at that 1971 Hebron case, the one where they focused on limiting the right to counsel in those pretrial things like bail hearings. Some people would say, hey, that's putting efficiency first, maybe even at the cost of some people who could really use a lawyer, even at those early stages.
Yeah, because there's that strong argument that everyone deserves a lawyer, no matter what, right?
Yeah.
Especially when they're up against the whole power of the state.
Oh, absolutely. Access to a lawyer. I mean, that's a cornerstone of a fair system. But then you have the Wayne Hebron case, where the judge is like this gatekeeper for the evidence. And that brings up a different idea, the idea that not every accusation, every charge should automatically end up in front of a jury.
So you're saying there needs to be a certain level of like proof, a solid foundation,
yeah,
before a full-blown trial happens.
Exactly.
So it's all about finding that balance point, right?
Right.
Protecting individual rights, but also making sure the system runs smoothly, that it's not wasting time and resources on cases that don't have enough merit.
You nailed it. And that's where all those legal discussions and debates come in. You've got some folks pushing for expanding the right to counsel, making sure people have lawyers at more stages of the process. Then you've got others who are saying, no, we need tougher rules about evidence, make it harder for flimsy cases to even get off the ground.
It's this fascinating back and forth, this constant struggle to figure out the right balance. And these Hebron cases, they give us a peek into how that plays out in the real world.
What's really important, especially for our listeners who are in the legal field, is to be aware of those tensions, those forces that are kind of shaping our justice system. Because when you understand them, you become a better advocate no matter which side you're on, whether you're prosecuting or defending.
So let's bring it back to you, our listener. What really stuck with you from these Hebron cases? What questions are swirling around in your head right now?
Maybe you're wrestling with that whole right to counsel debate. Do you think it should be expanded? Or do you find yourself nodding along with what the court said in that 1971 Hebron case?
Or maybe Wayne Hebron's case got you thinking about circumstantial evidence, how powerful it can be, but also how tricky it can be. How do we, as legal eagles, make sure that evidence is clear to a jury? How do we get them to understand just how much weight it carries in a case?
These are tough questions, you know. They're the kind of questions people are arguing about in courtrooms and classrooms all over the country. But when we wrestle with these questions, when we really dig into the cases that shape the legal world, well, we become better, sharper legal minds. And that makes the whole system better, fairer for everyone.
Well said. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Hebron v. State. We hope you learned something new, maybe even shifted your perspective a bit.
And until next time, keep those legal minds churning, keep asking those tough questions, and keep pushing for a better, more just legal system for all.
Thanks for listening, everyone.